I want to welcome you to Hope Community Church. If you are brand new with us this week, you are in for a treat. We are not in the middle of a two-year series in the middle of John, nor are we in the middle of a one-and-a-half-year series in the book of Acts or anything like that. We're in the beginning of something. You landed it on a good week, and it's only 6 weeks long. But it is going to be an absolute treat. And that we are going to look at the gospel according to Ruth. Now, obviously, the book of Ruth is in the Old Testament. So when we say the gospel according to Ruth, obviously it does not talk yet about Jesus Christ. They had no clue about that at that point. But this book is, in my view, the brightest spot, or at least one of the brightest spots, in the entire 39 books of the Old Testament. It is like a rose in the desert. And we'll see that hopefully by the time we're done with this series, hopefully you'll see that for sure. It is a very unique book. It is a book, if you can see, we call it a story of love, redemption, and faithfulness. You are going to see some things in this book that just are incredible, incredible bright spots. One of which is a phrase, we're going to touch on it today and next week. I just don't have time this week to hit on it, but it's this Hebrew phrase called chesed. Does anybody know what chesed means? Good. I'll tell you exactly what it means then. That's funny. Yeah, I think it is. It's a Hebrew word, and it's a very complicated word. I'm not sure if we have an English equivalent. It basically means loving kindness, but it means way more than that. It's kind of the most important concept in the Old Testament. May chesed be with you. H-E-S-E-D. It's this concept of covenant faithfulness. It's indicated by God. And we're going to see this idea of faithfulness and kindness expressed in two realms. We're going to see the realm of people with one another, and then we're also going to see it in the realm of God. This book is incredible in the sense, too, that it's primarily a story. There isn't a whole lot of, okay, here's the point. You have to kind of think about what that is. It's dialogue mostly. After we get through it today, it's primarily dialogue. It's 85 verses in the whole book of Ruth, four chapters, 85 verses, 55 of which are dialogue. So it's mostly this interaction, the same as if you were reading a novel, or you kind of have to piece together what's going on there. We're going to meet some people today, some very fascinating people. But out of that, like any book of the Bible, the main character is God. The main character of the book of Ruth is God, even though in the book of Ruth, he is not someone that is at all given a voice. He never gets to speak in the book of Ruth, nor is there anyone ever in his behalf speaking for him, like a prophet or somebody, or this is what God says. Never, not in the whole book. But we see his hand over the whole book. And by the time we're done, I'm hoping that you will fall in love with this little book of the Old Testament. When I was in seminary, we had to prepare four sermons from this book, chapters 1, 2, 3, and 4. And do they still do that at the seminary? You have to do Ruth anymore? You don't know. Anybody go to seminary anymore? Okay. They do still require that. I have no idea if they do or not. But over at Bethel, they used to require us to do four sermons from Ruth. And I can't find them, so I got to write them all up from scratch. Anyway, I'm sure the ones I've written now are much, much better than the ones I wrote 12, 13 years ago. Also, I don't have my on-ramp on me. Somebody want to throw me, lift up your on-ramp, that thing that you get, there you go, right there. It has the road on it. I'm not trying to give just a shameless plug here, but I would encourage you to read this little, on the front page there, I wrote a little something about someone in my life whose name is Ruth. And so you can read it whenever you're bored, which will probably be in about 6 minutes. So, that's all the stuff I wanted to say in the beginning here. Let's get into this book. It's an amazing, amazing book. We're going to try to cover all chapter 1 today. Verse 1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was famine in the land. Now, the whole message today really is setting the stage for these 6 weeks that we're in. Today, most of chapter 1 gets the characters, you get them introduced who you are. We find out a little bit more about who they are, what their issues are, a little bit about their background. And today is primarily about setting the stage for the future, setting the stage for the other one. So that's primarily what's going on today. So and today's going to be a lot of history kind of stuff too. So just hang with me on this stuff. Okay, chapter 1, verse 1, the days when the judges ruled. What does it mean, the days when the judges ruled? When is this book historically set? And that's all they put. They don't put a date. They don't put anything. They just say, in the days when the judges ruled. It was not written then. It couldn't have been. Because at the end of the book, it's a reference to David. And it's the reader, whoever would read it, would have picked up King David, which was significantly later. It was written during that time. But the events happened during this time of the judges. Now, the judges are not what, when we think of the word judges, we think of a guy sitting on a bench, Judge Judy or someone, you know, and that whole kind of thing, all right? The judges were the rulers of Israel. So they actually kind of came as more police officers, were given ultimate authority. That's who they were, and it was because of the mess that Israel had gotten themselves into. Basically, the book of Judges, if you were to diagram it out, it's this cycle. It's a continuing cycle. Israel starts off good, and then they start going into wicked ways, just wicked things all over the place, and they fall into perhaps even another country taking them over. This whole thing is going south, and they just fall into following other gods and paganism and doing horrible things with sacrificing of children and all kinds of things. It's just horrible, and it comes to the point, the very bottom, it bottoms out, and at that point, somebody gets an idea, God, help me, get me out of here. And God intervenes. He appoints a judge or someone to get them out of it. It comes over like this. They start doing really good, and then they fall right back into their ways. It's a cycle. And if you were to look at it, if you turn what I just did here in this circle like a clock, if you turned it this way so it's flat, it would cycle downward throughout the book of Judges. It gets darker and darker and darker and darker as you go through the book of Judges. It's a really, really depressing book. It just is. Just let me give you one example here. Judges chapter 6. Again, the Israelites. Hear that? Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And for 7 years, he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. So this foreign culture comes in, the Midianites, and takes control of Israel. Because of the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. They ditched their houses and went and lived in these shacks or these caves out in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the mountains. Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites and another foreign nation, Amalekites, and other eastern peoples invaded the country. They camped on the land and ruined the crops all the way to Gaza. It did not spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep nor cattle nor donkeys. They came up with their livestock and their tents like swarms of locusts. It was impossible to count the men and their camels. They invaded the land. They invaded the land to ravage it. Midian so impoverished the Israelites that this thing got so bad that I got an idea. They cry out to God for help, and he appoints a judge, and it helps. And there's this cycle. Oh, good, that got us out of that one. And then boom, next judge. It just keeps going on and on like this until you get to the very end of the book of Judges. And this is how the book of Judges ends. Chapter 21, verse 25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now, that might sound like, oh, that sounds great. Those of you anarchists out there listening to that heavy thrash music, that sounds like a real great time. This is like, I do whatever I want, thank you very much, and get out of my face. That's the kind of anarchy that's happening at the end of the book of Judges. That's how bad it's gotten. And that's where the next book in the Bible is Ruth. In the midst of somewhere in there, when things were all a mess, that's what happens. All right, there's a famine in the land. And it says, going back to Ruth chapter 1, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. We're going to meet them in just a second who they are. He's a guy from Bethlehem, which is in the country of Judah. And go to the Mac there, Tommy. I think that's the next one. There we go. I love the internet. I'm glad that Al Gore invented it. Really, seriously, I just nabbed this morning. I thought, oh, it'd be great to have a map. And so I just went on the internet, typed this in, got a map. It's so great. It's slick. I mean, I have no idea if it's accurate or true, but it's on the internet, so it's got to be true. You can see Bethlehem over there on the left-hand side. In order to go to Moab, there's this big lake in the middle, a Dead Sea, and you'd have to go around it that way or that way. And it says that they sojourned. Now, to sojourn is an interesting word, not one we use very often. It means to journey, a long vacation. In other words, you go somewhere, but the idea is you're coming back. It's not, I went there to live. All right, you're not going there. The old phrase, nice place to visit, wouldn't want to live there. That's what they're doing here. They're going to Moab. Now, who are the Moabites? It's a good question. Like, if you're going to another place, you should know a little bit about the place. Those of you who venture across Minnesota River here and go to that other state across there, you should know a little bit about those people because they're weird. You ever seen the movie Deliverance? No, just kidding. I went on record. Vikings 28. Packers 4. That's my record. I'm going on record. And they're saying 4. Two safeties. That's all they're going to get. Anyway, how did they become a nation? How did the Moabites become this nation? It's really weird. It's really weird. Genesis chapter 19. There's this guy by the name of Lot. Lot is a relative of Abraham. If you're at all familiar with the Old Testament, there's this guy by the name of Abraham. He comes around the scene in Genesis chapter 12 for no particular reason other than God knows what he's doing. He picks Abraham to start a nation with. Abraham and his wife Sarah have no children. They start this nation. It takes a long time for Abraham and Sarah to get pregnant. They're in their old age. They have their first child. And then everything takes off from there. A relative of Abraham is a guy by the name of Lot. If you're familiar with Sodom and Gomorrah, he lived there. Lot, to put it simply, has issues. His daughters are even more whacked than Lot. Listen to this now. Listen to where this came from. Lot and his two daughters left Zoar and settled in the mountains, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar. He and his two daughters lived in a cave. Nice. One day, we're social services, you know, when you need them. Anyway, one day, the older daughter said to the younger, "Our father is old, and there is no man around here to lie with us, as is the custom over all the earth." Yes, it is. "Let's get our father to drink wine, and then lie with him, and preserve our family line through our father." Okay, that's one idea. You know, when we're brainstorming, there's no bad ideas here. All right, that's one idea. Anybody else got a second idea? They don't have a second idea. That's the one they go with. "That night they got their father to drink wine, and the older daughter went and lay with him. He was not aware of it." Got to help me with this one. But anyway, not aware of it when she lay down or when she got up. "The next day the older daughter said to the younger, 'Last night I lay with my father. Let's get him to drink wine again tonight. And you go and lie with him so he can preserve our family line through our father.' So they got their father to drink wine that night also, and the younger daughter went and lay with him. Again, he was not aware of it, and when she lay down or when she got up, so both of Lot's daughters became pregnant by their father. The older daughter had a son, and she named him Moab." Oh, nice. "He is the father of the Moabites today. The younger daughter also had a son, and she named him Ben-Ammi. He is the father of the Amorites today." And throughout the rest of the Old Testament, you see Israel fighting against many clans, two of which are the Moabites and the Amorites. Nice job. Now, the Moabites were people that Israelites were kind of repulsed by because of this. This was viewed, the Bible describes this. It doesn't say that's a good thing to do. Don't hear that, okay? They just said it's what happened. They're not. It's one thing that proves to me that the Bible's true, because it shows how many people actually seriously screwed up. And they just put it in there. Just like, that's what happened. Whoa, that's dumb. Okay, made sense at the time. And there's these tribes now, or nations, that end up happening over generation after generation after generation that have this as their background. And they become enemies of Israel. And this is their starting point. Moab was not a place that you would go for it if you were an Israelite. You were not supposed to go there. These were not generally friendly people with you, and yet that's where they go. Now let's talk about that. Verse 2, "The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife, Naomi, and the name of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem and Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there." Now, in Hebrew, names mean something, all right? It's just if you read their Bible, you can see a little footnote. It usually shows you something. These are a little bit hard to translate. I'm going to boil it down to simple. Elimelech means God is mighty. God is able to save. God is completely in control, or something similar to that. Naomi means pleasant or wonderful, which, whoa, baby, she's going to have a bit of a shift on that one. But the two children are very, very interesting. Mahlon means, ooh, broke my glasses. Mahlon means son of destruction, or sickly one. Excuse me, that's the other one. Mahlon means sickly one. Like, can you imagine naming your kid sickly one? Let's see, Bob? Nah. Harry? No. How about sickly one? Now, can you imagine what it's like being a kid your whole life? Hey, sickly one, come on over here and play with us. That's what they named the kid. The second kid was, it's hard to translate, but it means one for destruction, or destructed one, or, you know, failure, or all kinds of different horrible things. That's what they named the kids. This family is keeping the fun and dysfunctional. Okay, this family is got some problems. There's this father who decides to leave Bethlehem. Yes, it's not the safest place. Yes, there's a famine going on, but he goes to Moab, not the place where he should be going. He takes his family there, and they have serious issues. Now, the narrator gives him a pass. Doesn't say this is bad. Doesn't say naming the kids. Maybe you should have looked in the baby book or something. Doesn't do anything. The narrator just says, this is what happened. He also goes on to say, when tragedy strikes, he also gives them another pass. Verse 3. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died. And she was left with her two sons. That's, we never hear about Elimelech again. That's the end of him. He dies. He leaves his family over there in the middle of Moab without a husband. What happens to the boys? The boys took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. There we go. Name of the book. They lived there about 10 years, and then both Mahlon and Chilion die. So that the woman, that's Naomi now, was left without her two sons and her husband. Now, what they're trying to do here is paint you a picture of just utter despair. Let's look at another decision they made. They go to Moab. They go up there just to get bread. I guess you could excuse that. But when you get to the fact where now they give the boys over to marriage to this other culture that was expressly forbidden for a Jewish boy to take a foreign wife. Now, if you're a lawyer here, and we know we had a bunch of lawyers here at the first service. I don't know if we have any lawyers second service, but we did first service, and it was really scary, actually. In fact, Dan, not you, Dan, I pointed right where he was sitting. Dan was sitting right there. He's a lawyer, first service, and he's a lawyer, and he sent me a little joke about lawyers. What's black and brown and looks good on a lawyer? A Rottweiler. That was Dan's joke. That's terrible. It's terrible. Is that outside voice? That was outside voice. But if you're a lawyer type and you just stick to the rules, you could look at the Bible, Deuteronomy chapter 7, and say, I got a loophole here. Look at Deuteronomy 7. It says, when the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, the Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, seven nations larger and stronger than you. Notice, doesn't mention the Moabites. So you go, oh, loophole. And when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and you have defeated them, then you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them and show them no mercy. Do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons. For they will turn your sons away from you, free from following me to serve other gods, and the Lord's anger will burn against you and will quickly destroy you. He's saying, you don't understand. These people are just going to completely pull you away from me. I do not want you, certainly not, intermarrying with them. The point of that whole passage is, don't marry people who are outside the faith and will take you away from me. That's what God is saying. Don't do that. Now you could say, well, it's not specifically said Moabite, but these Moabites had foreign gods. They had gods that were just the pagan gods of the nations. They shouldn't have been there. So, with all this going on, 10 years goes by, they live in this land, something happens. Verse 6. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. The famine was over and she hears about this. Now at this point in time, Naomi's got three options being husbandless. Number one, she can try to stay there and work in some trade or craft. Now we have to take from inference here that she probably didn't have a trade or craft, and a single woman of age at that point in time would have no other, in that culture, would have no other means of living. Two, she could return back to her mother and father in her home country. We don't hear anything about her mother and father, so we have to assume that they are no longer living. And the third thing, for the life of me, I can't think of the third thing. I should have written these down. There's a third thing, and it's really interesting. There's another option, but she couldn't do it. What was that option? Looking at you, you're supposed to know. I don't know. Listen to first service. I can't. Third option. When I said these first service, I said, I'm never going to remember the third one, and I did. But this time, the third option. Stay home. Go back. Buy stock. I don't remember what the third one is. I'll tell you next week. It's escaping me for the moment. All right. She can't do any of the three. She can't do any of the three. And so she's, what am I doing? What am I going to do? I might as well just go home and see what I can do there. At least there's food there. Verse 7. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. So here, this is very important. She's on her way. She takes her two daughters-in-law. She's going back. She's got all their gear, everything she owns from the 10 years of being in Moab. She's on her way back. And she's traveled the distance. We don't know how far, but she's traveled some distance. Then something happens. Verse 8. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. What she's saying here is, she's gone a certain distance, and then it comes to her and she says, there is no future for you, two daughters-in-law. There's no future for you. You guys go back. Now, maybe the first thought in their mind is, geez, could you have told us that 30 miles ago? I mean, why didn't you think of that when we were just, before we were packing up? She gets there and she says, there is none. But she gives them, amazingly, a blessing. One of the cool things in the book of Ruth is that no person ever prays for their own welfare. The prayers and the blessings are always for someone else. It's this amazing thing of blessing. And here that word hesed is used. She says, may the Lord, and here it is, deal kindly with you. May the Lord hesed on you. May he just give you blessing, covenant, faithfulness, and love, so that because you've dealt with me that way and my dead husband and my dead sons, you have been great to me. I want you to return. It says, the Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you in the house of her husband. They don't have husbands yet. She's wishing upon them that they would have husbands. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices, and they wept. And that's her, what she says to them. She's on the journey. She comes over to here. She says, why don't you guys go back? And their response back is, no, we will return with you to your people. Now, there's two different women here. There's Orpah. That's just too easy, sorry. There's Orpah, and then there's Ruth. And they both say this. You never know in the Bible if they both said it in unison or if they both just meant, I don't know, no, we will return with you to your people. That's what they said. But what did they really mean? Now, when I was a kid, I grew up with a mother who's Norwegian and a father who's German. Last name's Treichler. My mother's maiden name is Tullerud, with dots over the A's. I mean, we're talking as Norwegian as you can get. There's different ways of communicating between those two families. You haven't figured that out. If anybody grew up Norwegian, you know what I'm talking about? Norwegian. You're at the dinner table. This actually happened. At the dinner table, would you like some more potatoes? No. How about now? Would you like some more potatoes? I mean, like 10 seconds? No. Can I get you? And she'll bring up the pot and put it right in your face. Would you like some potatoes? That's the third time. It's known as the third time rule in Norway. On the third time, then you're allowed to say, you know, actually, I would like some. Thank you very much. My mother's dating my father. My father They go to his house. My dad's not aware of the law of the land of the three. Neither is my grandmother. My grandmother says, "You want some more potatoes?" And my mom says, "No, thanks." She says, "Okay." And they talk about something else. My mom is ticked. What is the deal? She only asked me once. "Well, did you want some more?" "Well, of course I wanted some more." "Why didn't you take some?" "Because you wait until you're asked the third time before you. It's rude not to." Oh, didn't write. My dad wrote that one down, you know? Orpah and Ruth say, "We're going back." But we're going to see in a second what Orpah meant was, "See ya. Thank you very much. I am out of here." Look at verse 10. "It was definitely for Orpah, a Norwegian, no. And they said to her, no, we will turn to people." Verse 11. "But Naomi said, 'Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you wait for them to get married? Would you wait till they're grown up to get married?' And then she says, 'No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake.'" We're going to see Naomi in just a second. She's just bitter to be bitter. But at this moment, she's bitter for what their lives are. Now, if you're reading this, you're going, what's the line of logic here? The line of logic why you shouldn't come with us is, I don't have a husband. I'm not going to be able to get pregnant. You'd have to wait for the boys to grow up to marry them. What kind of sick society? I mean, what are you talking about? Why is that a reason of logic why you shouldn't come with? It is if you understand what goes on in the special case, in Jewish culture, when a brother dies early in his life. Deuteronomy 7. I gotta read this. This is fascinating. Deuteronomy chapter 25. This is a Moses is giving a rule of how to live life and how to be honorable and to carry on one's lineage. Deuteronomy chapter 25. "If brothers are living together and one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside the family. Her husband's brother shall take her and marry her and fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to her. The first son she bears shall carry on the name of the dead brother, so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel." It was the way of carrying on someone's name. It's a real neat idea. "However, if a man does not want to marry his brother's wife, she shall go to the elders at the town gate and say, 'My husband's brother refuses to carry on his brother's name in Israel. He will not fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to me.' Then the elders of the town shall give him the what fors and summon him." I added that. And talk to him. If he persists in saying, 'I do not want to marry her,' here's the punishment. This is fascinating. "His brother's widow shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, take off one of his sandals, spit in his face, and say, 'This is what is done to the man who will not build up his brother's family line. That man's line shall be known in Israel as the family of the unsandaled.'" Scary. The sequel, "The Family of the Unsandaled 2, you know. Ah! But that's what it was. It was just a disgrace not to do this. And that's the lineage she's trying to carry on. If you're going to follow my customs, you're going to come into my land, you got to follow my customs. What you do, because my sons died young, is what a husband for you would be, following this custom. You have to wait till I get pregnant. I don't even have a husband. Then you got 10 months, and then you got at least 14, 15 years before they're even possible. The women at that time, let's just say they married very early, and they did in that culture, 14, 15. They said it was 10 years. They're 25. They'd be 39 married to a 14-year-old. And she says, that's why you shouldn't come. Orpah says, works for me. I'm out of here. Look at verse 11. "Then they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her." Orpah says, that's good. That works for me. You want my best? And the person who wrote Ruth, the narrator here, does not rip on Orpah for that decision. It's not a bad decision. She did what was good. Ruth does what is better. She clings. She squeezes the living stuffings out of Ruth. And she's hanging on. And she said, And she is Naomi, the mother-in-law. See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. Now listen to what Ruth says back. But Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. Stop talking like that. Stop ordering me to do that. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. And this next sentence is one of the most famous in the book of Ruth. It's the moment when Ruth converts. She changes her complete nationality and she changes her complete orientation to who is supreme in her life. It says, your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you. Ruth makes a hardcore covenant. Hardcore covenant with Naomi. And she asks Naomi for nothing in return. It's huge. The commitment she makes, I will leave my nation and I will leave their religion. And I will chase after your people and I will chase after your God. It is the moment of conversion for Ruth. And she makes it in a strong statement saying, if I don't fulfill this, may God deal with me so severely. I mean, she's saying, may God even deal with me worse than death. I'm not sure what that would be, but it's worse. Now, it's hard for us in this culture, especially of non-committal to anything, to really grasp what this means. We just don't have that kind of long-term commitment to things. We don't understand what this is saying. Oftentimes people talk about that way when you even talk about if they're a Christian. What does it mean to be a Christian? And that word, I don't like that word. I mean, that sounds terrible for a pastor to say, but it doesn't mean anything anymore. I just insert the phrase, I'm a follower of Jesus. People ask me that. I'm on an airplane. I'm reading my Bible. They say, are you religious? I say, no. What do you do for a living? I'm a pastor. I'm just a follower of Jesus. I'm not into this whatever you conceive a Christian to be. But if I were to say, are you married? You would answer yes or no. I mean, yes or no. Even if you're going through a divorce. Before that, you're still married or not. Well, I am, but it's going to be changing. It's definition. So I'm not asking whether or not you're a good Christian or a bad Christian or if you're a good follower of Jesus or not. I'm asking if you're one. And Ruth makes it real clear that it comes by a covenant. It comes by a decision, a clear decision to say, Jesus Christ, you are who you said you are. You're living. You're my sin bearer. I want you to take my sin and I'm going to follow you. It's that simple. But it's a major covenant. It's like when people stand right here and get married. Whatever they say in their vows, one of the things that they say is, forsaking all others, I choose you. That's what it means to be a Christian. Forsaking all others as my God, Christ, I take you. And to use the analogy to push it, I'm the bride and you are the husband and I take you as my husband. So it's kind of a deal where you are or you're not. I'm not asking how good you are at it. Are you a good wife or a bad wife? That's not my question. The question is, have you went through that covenant experience saying, Christ, going to church doesn't make me a follower of you. Being a member of a church, looking a certain way, dressing a certain way, all that stuff is so secondary. Have you gone through the ceremony? And that's between you and Christ, you and God. That's it. No one else can be involved in that. It's a covenant between that. And that's what Ruth is making here. What makes this even interesting, more interesting, is that Ruth is simultaneously with that is covenanting to Naomi. This complete cast off by society. That there's no hope for her. Ruth says, if you're a sinking ship, I'm going down with you. It's huge love. Ruth relents then. Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her. She said, no more. So they go on their journey and they arrive at Bethlehem. The two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. So wait a minute now. Here's the deal. There they come back. That's Naomi. Where's Elimelech? Where are the children? They went out as four. They're coming back as one with this real tan girl with them. Who's the tan girl and what's the deal? What's going on? They see them and they 10 years ago, but they remember them. And the woman said, "Is this Naomi?" It's a nice way of saying, "Hey, Naomi, haven't seen you in a while." Look at how Naomi replies. "Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? Pleasant." Don't call me pleasant. I am Mara. Mara means bitter. I am bitter. I know I have a good authority. That's how she said it. I'm bitter. "I call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me. You know, I'm not going to blame my husband who had the right smart idea to go vacation in Moab. I'm going to blame God. God did this and I'm angry about it. I'm bitter about it. Don't call me Naomi." Dude, all I said is, "How's it going? Hadn't seen you in 10 years and you're chowing all over me." This is the definition of bitter old woman. Bitter. "How you doing today?" "Wow, why do you ask that? Terrible." "Whoa, okay." Bitter, angry. I like how these people change their name. You know, the rest of the book, she's known as Naomi. So she had this phase, right, when she met him, and she wanted to be the Mara phase. You know, that was my Mara phase. It would be great if we had that. "How are you doing today?" "I'm happy today. Call me happy. Call me joyful. Call me Skippy," or whatever, you know. But this is, she doesn't want her name changed. At least when she's coming into town, "I want to be called Mara." And I want to let that sink in. We're going to watch a transformation of Naomi. You know who's going to do it? Humanly speaking, Ruth. This girl who comes from pagan backgrounds, knows nothing of God, understands more about God than Naomi, who's got all the rules right. She knows who she's supposed to marry due to these rules in the Old Testament and all these different things. Ruth is going to be the one that really blesses Naomi. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. And that opens up the setting for what's about to take place. It's a dark background. It's this hopeless situation. A mother and a daughter-in-law, both without money, without husbands, in a culture that would potentially cast them aside with that. As you look at this, realize that God is a genius. God is sovereign over all things. And he puts things, he allows things, things take place in your life. And you're going to watch even in this orchestration of the book of Ruth, how he takes these events in this black backdrop to paint a beautiful picture on it. But at the time, and I want you to bask in what Naomi's going through, she is angry. She is bitter. She is disillusioned. She left with a family. She comes back, according to her, with no one, which is an interesting way of interpreting events, because here's this woman who said, "I'll die with you if necessary." But Naomi can't even see that. She says, "I came back empty." I was talking to Jess Sapinski, and Jess and I share, and some of you other ones are in the fellowship of the back pain. I have, in 2000, I had back surgery, and about 1991, I had my first back injury, and I just have had back troubles off and on over, and about 8 or 9 days ago, I threw up my back. And when I throw up my back, it's one of those deals like, all right, is this going to be a couple days, or is this going to be 6 weeks of kind of laying in a fetal position or what? I never really know. And the way I did it was, I was taking Calvin, I was going to pile drive him right on his head. And I did, too. And Dave's fine. He's fine. The surgery worked. As I was lifting him, and lifting and twisting, stupid, right? Lifting, twist, dumb. And I did that, and there it went. As soon as it goes, the next thing out of my mouth is, "Jesus, help me. There's no way I can do anything with this." And God uses those things in our lives God's going to use this event. You're going to watch in the next three chapters, unbelievably, how this event unfolds for God's glory and for our joy. So let's pray together. Lord, I do want to thank you for this book of the Bible, this beautiful book of the Bible. Lord, I want to thank you for hardships that we get to witness in other people and especially in the Scriptures. God, I also want to thank you for hardships we go through in our own lives. Not that anyone wants to go through hard things, no way. But God, that you allow them to take place to shape us and make us who we're supposed to be. God, I want to thank you for people in this room right now who are going through such difficulties it makes them feel like they want to just say, call me Mara, for I am bitter. I was pleasant, but now I'm bitter. I pray, oh God, that they would see the beautiful light at the end of the tunnel. They would see your plan. You would not allow that bitterness to become something that they decide to worship. They decide to land in. They decide to keep. Lord, I pray for other people in this room who, looking at their own lives, are asking, what's the condition of my covenant with Jesus after looking at Ruth's covenant? Lord, whether it be for the very first time in their lives that they would bend their knee to you, or for the 10,000th time, Jesus, I pray that we would all renew our covenant to you, that you will be our God, and that we'll follow you, no matter what. Because through the storms of life, God, the only thing that's going to make sense is the North Star, and that's you. And everything else in this world is so shifting and crazy, God, that you are the one we need to orient ourselves to. So I pray, Lord God, by your Holy Spirit, you just communicate the things that people need in this room. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.